This is the current federal tax update for the week of August 18, 2014, brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and by your state society of CPAs. Any use of this podcast or other material without the express written consent of Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your state society of CPAs is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to take a look at this point of some of the developments that have taken place this week in federal taxes. We're going to start with the Chief Counsel Advice 2014-33015 that deals with a question about assignment of income and information reporting. The situation in question involves a state-run gambling addiction treatment program that individuals who feel they have gambling problems could sign up with the state in question. Those individuals would enter the Voluntary Exclusion Program, or VEP. Those that entered that program would agree not to enter a casino. If they did enter a casino, they could be arrested for trespassing. If not being arrested for trespassing, they went ahead and played games in the casino and won, they agreed to forfeit the money they won to the state. Generally, this would be caught because the casinos are given a list of people who are participating in the program. And the casinos, if they end up having to pay out to somebody, checks against the list of VEP participants. If the winner shows up on the VEP list, the money is not paid to the participant, not paid to the gambler, I should say, but actually paid to the state, which used it for its gambling addiction treatment programs. The question that came up was twofold. Number one, does a casino have to issue a 1099 to a VEP winner whose winnings end up being paid to the state? And number two, does that person have to report the income under the theory of assignment of income? And the IRS answered no to both. In the first case, the IRS concluded that the 1099 reporting requirements for a casino only apply if the casino pays out the funds to the individual. And in this case, they're not paying it to the individual, but to the state. And the IRS concluded that the assignment of income rule did not apply because the individual had essentially irrevocably agreed to assign the income to the state or to let this give the state the income. So that person had no right to the income to begin with, and that was known before they ever started doing anything or making any gambling. Because of that, they don't report the income either. Next, we're going to consider a tax court summary opinion case. This is a case of Luciano Salas versus Commissioner. Tax Court Summary Opinion 2014-76. This deals with the question of equitable ownership of a residence. In this case, the taxpayer, Dolorosa Luciano Salas, claimed that her sister had purchased a residence and that was really the taxpayer's residence in this case, and that the taxpayer had let that happen or had requested the sister to do this because of her poor credit. This is an argument that we've heard quite a lot and has in fact been supported by the courts before to find equitable ownership where somebody has, in essence, a piece of property bought for them by somebody else, but they go ahead and pay all the payments and the agreement between the parties is such that this other party, the one who's trying to claim the deductions, is going to be the party actually responsible for all payments and anything that happens on the property. In this case, the property was a duplex, and the taxpayer in this case, Dolorosa, was claiming both deductions for the residence, that is, her own mortgage interest, and also deductions related to a rental activity going on in the duplex. She claimed that her sister lived with her sister's husband in a neighboring state. Now, there were a couple of problems here. The only evidence that supported her view that she was the equitable owner was her testimony. She produced no written agreement with her sister indicating that, in fact, she was responsible for all of this, nor did she produce her sister to testify at the trial. And there were more negative facts. Number one, only about two or three payments were made on the mortgage in the year in question, and it couldn't be established with certainty as to who paid them. Next, the problem was that her sister had filed Chapter 13 bankruptcy. And in the various bankruptcy filings that she had filed, Her sister claimed that this property was that person's, her basically the title holder, that is, the sister who supposedly lived in the neighboring state's residence. That had given her an advantage in bankruptcy, and in fact, she received damages in the bankruptcy case based on that position when a lender attempted to foreclose on the property, and they went against that, arguing that the lender could not move forward while the bankruptcy was pending. Obviously, somebody wasn't quite telling the truth about whose residence this truly was. The problem for De La Rosa is that she's in front of the court and she has no evidence besides her testimony. The court finds, therefore, that she failed to carry her burden of proof, requiring that she shows that she's justified in claiming the deductions, and for this reason, her deductions were disallowed in this case. Next up is the case of RERI Holdings versus Commissioner, 143 Tax Court Number 3. This is a case that has a lot of things happening in the case, and it technically was just a motion for summary judgment on a couple of issues. The motion was denied, but we did get a ruling that's of interest. In 2009, in the case of Pierre versus Commissioner, 113 TC Number 24, the tax court had held that a gift of an interest in a single member LLC that was disregarded for federal income tax purposes must nevertheless be paid attention to, that is, we value the LLC interest and not the underlying assets when a gift is made. In that case, it enabled Suzanne Pierre to obtain discounts for giving that interest, that partial interest in the LLC. This case looked at a different issue. Now we're going to a charitable contribution. This was a charitable contribution of an interest. Actually, it was a remainder interest, and there's lots of side issues related to that that are not really decided by this case. But basically, it was a remainder interest in a piece of real estate. However, that piece of real estate was held, not unusually in today's under today's situations, in a single-member LLC. The single-member LLC's sole asset was that piece of real estate. The taxpayer's appraiser had appraised not the single-member LLC, which was the interest that was given, but rather appraised the real estate inside of it. The tax court held that the Pierre decision still applies. You do not ignore the LLC despite the fact that it's a disregarded entity for federal tax purposes, because the court's position is having it inside the LLC could very well affect the value, and what you get as a charitable contribution is based on the value of what was given. Rather, the same rule the court finds should apply for gift taxes, should apply for income taxes as applies for gift taxes. The court did hold, however, that this might be a no harm, no foul situation if the taxpayer could show that the value of the LLC, because it would be 100% interest, was equivalent to the value of the real estate in question. The court did not hold that was true because in this case there was a bunch of other issues related to what was given, which the court is holding back for trial. But what it does suggest is if you have a taxpayer that gives real estate and that real estate is being held in a single-member LLC for liability protection, for insulation from ecological, we have those issues, ecological damages that could exist due to problems that have been done with contamination of the property, that it happened prior to their ownership, and that's often done with LLCs to try to insulate from that and keep off the chain of title. You've got to make sure that what is valued is the LLC interest and not the real estate. While the court holds that maybe you could show no harm, no foul, and that the two are the same, it's probably best not to have to try to fall back and rely on that position. The IRS finally finalized the Tangible Property Capitalization Repair Project regulations, finalizing the remaining set of regulations under Section 168I that related to general asset accounts. Now, the major use of these particular ones that have been reissued as proposed regulations last year results from when we go to write off structural components of a building. Now, it affects any other use of general asset accounts for maker's property, but for the most part, most of us aren't using that terribly often. But this will allow us, if we replace the roof of a building, to go ahead and write off the old roof, even though we didn't place that on depreciation schedule as a separate asset. The real changes in the regs, not much was done to go to final. There are only minor changes. The most significant one took away in one example of what's a reasonable method of allocating the two, went ahead and got rid of the option of using consumer price index and replaced it with producer price index, the service concluded that that was a more realistic way of measuring the change in value of a building. Nevertheless, aside from that, no real major changes. These regulations are now finalized, so the last uncertainty with the repair regulations is now taken care of. We now have all the rules final for this year. Next up is a Chief Counsel Advice 2014-33014. This particular Chief Counsel Advice deals with the problems that exist for a Q-sub. When its parent, which is also, by the way, has to be an S corporation, decides to revoke its S election. Under the standard rules of Section 1362, when an S corporation revokes its S status, that's a voluntary removal where we say we no longer want to be an S corporation as of this date, we end up splitting the year, assuming it's not done at year end, between an S year and a C year. And by default, we allocate income on a per-day basis. We compute income for the year as a whole. Then if there were, let's say, 200 days before the S election was revoked and 165 days after, we would go 200 divided by 365 of the income or loss be allocated to the S period, and the rest, 165 or 365, be allocated to the C period. However, Regulation 1.1361-5 states that whenever Q-sub status ends, and Q-sub status ends the minute we have an owner of shares in the entity that is not an S corporation, we are deemed as of that date to contribute assets to a brand new corporation that suddenly springs into being. The problem there, of course, is that new corporation is and would remain a C corp. The question the Chief Counsel Advice had to deal with was, well, in this particular case, where it's becoming a C corp, the subsidiary is becoming a C corp, by the way, filing a consolidated return with the parent, do we go ahead and use the standard 1362 rules if the parent does not elect to cut off the books, or do we have to go ahead and still cut off the books for activities in the Q-sub because of Regulation 1.1361-5? And the Chief Counsel Advice comes to the conclusion that, in fact, we have to go ahead and cut off. We have no option but to use a cutoff method for the Q-sub. Once it ceases being a Q-sub, we have the brand new corporation formed. Once that new corporation has been formed, we simply have no option to go ahead and go back to doing a pro rata over the year. The Q-sub has to be treated under a cutoff method. In this particular case, the taxpayer was not thrilled with that option because the Q-sub had substantial losses after the date on which the S status was revoked by the parent. It had increasing losses, and they wanted to allocate that back to the S period. Reality was they were not allowed to do so per this Chief Counsel Advice. We'll see whether the taxpayer decides to push this matter, and we have later cases that come up on this, but this is certainly what the National Office claimed. In Chief Counsel Advice 2014-33013, we're going to revisit an issue that was decided by the IRS earlier this year. In another Chief Counsel Advice, 2014-14015, this is the same situation faced then. In that prior Chief Counsel Advice, we had an entity that was in the process of acquiring a subsidiary. Under the terms of the agreement, they acquired stock at certain dates, and the prices were set by the agreement. Now, at the date in which, in a year in question, they had acquired enough to go over 50% by the beginning of the year, and had an absolute right later in that year to acquire enough to go over 80%. The taxpayer had claimed that once they had that beginning of that year, because of their absolute right to require the other 30%, the fact they did, meant that they could consolidate as of day one. The prior Chief Counsel Advice determined that no, consolidation could not take place till they actually acquired the other 30%, despite having a fixed price and a fixed time period, a date at which they would require the other 30%. The taxpayer, receiving that term from the National Office, protested back to the agent and raised two other points, claiming that that prior Chief Counsel Advice was an error. And their claim in this case was that two things they hadn't paid attention to. That once the buyer had 50% control, the buyer effectively divested the seller of any real right to dividends or rights in distribution, since the buyer could just delay until after the seller got out of the picture before making either dividend distributions or allowing the entity to liquidate. So they're saying we're in effective control once we go above 50%. The IRS National Office disagreed with that view, stating that it had been established multiple times that effective control does not allow you to go ahead and consolidate. Rather, you have to have 80%. The law requires 80%. They did not hold 80%. The seller then argued a second point was, well, regardless of whether we owned 80%, we had the benefits and burdens of ownership of all the 80%, of more than 80% of the company as of that date, since any value increase or decrease after that date would go to us. We'd either pick up the value for any increase or we'd have to take the hit for any decrease in value. The National Office pointed out that while benefits and burdens is an issue and determination of ownership under federal law, it's much more complicated than merely who's going to get the increase or decrease in value. The memo went on and focused on a number of five different criteria. And they noted that they only met one of the five criteria, that is the increase or decrease in value. They did not have legal title to the stock. They could not dispose of the stock beyond the 50% as of that date. They did not have the right to vote the stock. Regardless of whether that vote meant anything, they still couldn't vote it. The other party could vote the stock. And they did not have physical possession of the stock. Therefore, the IRS concluded they failed the benefits and burdens test as well. So for that reason, the IRS held that until they actually had the 80% of shares in their control, they were not allowed to combine. Finally, we're going to take a look at the case of McElroy versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-163. Mr. McElroy invested in three super aggressive partnerships in the late 90s. These partnerships went and bought lots of land that were to be used for cemeteries and then would give them to charitable organizations. In theory, it was going to be more than a year later. Turns out the promoter couldn't quite wait that long, so he gave it less than a year later. That's a problem. But the valuations put on these were way above the value, way above the amount that had been paid to begin with. Not surprisingly, the IRS came and examined these partnerships and decided even to open a criminal investigation into the promoter, finally actually coming down and receiving indictments, and eventually this guy served time in jail. Now, the IRS issued a FPAA to the tax matters partner, who happened to be the promoter, at a time when he was under criminal investigation. In fact, they issued the FPAA simply because the tax matters partner would not extend the statute after discovering he was under criminal investigation. In response to that, the tax matters partner filed a tax court petition. Eventually, the McElroys petitioned the court and became the new tax matters partner after pointing out that this guy was now incarcerated and it might be a little tough for him to run this program. So they prosecuted the case for a while, but eventually they got thrown out because they went into personal bankruptcy. Eventually, the case is settled and a assessment is now issued against them many, many years later. These were late 90s partnerships. We're talking about a case that has just now come to trial. The taxpayers claimed the FPAAs were invalid because they were issued to somebody who was not eligible to be a TMP. The tax court disagreed for two reasons. Number one, the court said the validity of the FPAA was a proper issue at the partnership level, and since these guys became the TMP and had the right to raise that question, the reality was that wasn't raised, and tough luck, this is the wrong place to raise it. But number two, even if their case was correct on that theory, which the court does not believe it was, but even if it was, this individual, even if not properly tax matters partner, still had the right to bind the partnership to extend the statute. So therefore, they were able to be assessed tax over that period, and that means tax plus penalties and interest. This has been the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 18th. Be sure to join us next week when we'll take a look at the developments in the upcoming week for federal taxes.